Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Elise Manitol, and this week I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Andy Scahill about film, queer theory, and the pleasure of being bad. Take a listen. Awesome. Well, if you just want to, before we dive in, introduce yourself, name, pronouns, and some hats you're wearing in the community right now.
Yeah, my name's Andy Scahill, he, him pronouns, and I'm a professor at CU Denver. I teach film in the English department, and I do a couple things in town, some events that for me are about, you know, bringing people together. And one of them is a sing-along bingo at Triangle from 7 to 9 every Thursday. And then the one I'm really excited about is new. It's called Rainbow Cult, and that is an interactive queer camp cinema night that has props and drag numbers, and that's all at C Film Center.
Amazing. Well, that teased me right up to ask you, what makes a queer cult classic film? Because when I was looking at the list of movies, it seems like lots of classics, lots of camp, cult classics. So if you could just give some definitions about what that would be.
Yeah, you know, the basic rule that I went forward with is films that queer people love to quote. Is there something about like the exchange of lines from a film that says, I'm part of this subculture, you're also part of this subculture if you get it. And the way that we kind of create memes, and it's sort of in that modern era, things that have an afterlife. And that's usually how we define cult movies, are films that maybe did okay or even bad upon their initial release, but then have found this audience, this subcultural audience, which just sort of loves them. So those are the ones I was looking for, things that attracted fandom among gay people, things that queers love to quote, and things that just had this this afterlife in the gay community.
Well, I feel like I can't not ask about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts? Do you love it, hate it? Is it overplayed?
I don't know. I mean, it has, talk about a film with an afterlife. I mean, gosh, it's just been sort of embraced. It's become this really interesting hybrid of live theater and film. In some ways, it harkens back to like a film that used to be part of a vaudeville show, you know, that it wasn't necessarily the main feature. I love it. I love it for what it is. I love its unabashed queerness. I love the fact that it is unrepentantly weird, and that it kind of draws people back over and over again, generation after generation.
It's true. So I guess that makes me think too about like our OG queer villain. Mm. And I know that a lot of your work is about horror and using queer theory and film theory. So what are your thoughts about like queer-coded villains, and how does that intersect with your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my books is called The Revolting Child in Horror Cinema, Youth Rebellion and Queer Spectatorship. And it's kind of about how the figure of the child in horror cinema can be read as a metaphor for queer youth, how evil children tend to be gender non-normative. Evil girls tend to be bodies out of control, like Carrie or The Exorcist. And evil boys tend to be effeminate and withdrawn, like The Omen. So there are already kind of problems of gender. But then the stories that we tell about evil children are the child that has a secret, like The Bad Seed, another camp classic. The child that's not mine and I have to reject it, like The Omen or Village of the Damned. The child has to go out and find others like them and recruit, like Children of the Corn. Or if you look at something like The Exorcist, it's about a girl who's normal. When puberty hits, she turns into a monster, and the mom has to call upon the church to pray it out of her. I mean, if that doesn't sound like conversion therapy, I don't know what does.
When I imagine that there's this sort of push and pull when thinking about horror from this queer theory lens, like things are being queered, or it's sort of being played up as queer in a way that could be stigmatizing. How do you balance that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The kind of early rhetoric around queerness and representation, say like the early days of GLAAD, it was very much about positive representations. And that's great. But often positive representations are kind of sanitized, they're sexless, they're often the kind of clowns of the film. I think in later years, we've really thought about the power of the villain, how fun it is to identify with the villain. And especially if the villain is revolting against the church, the state, parents, which is why I think that the queer child or the revolting child is so pleasurable to me. Because, you know, when I watch The Exorcist, I know that the film, when Regan vomits on the priest, I know the film says, that's disgusting, you should be disgusted, but I think it's hilarious. And so what does that say about me? You know, what is my kind of subject position, and how do I derive pleasure from that or read against the grain, let's say. But, you know, as time goes on, I think laughing at that scene is probably the normative reaction rather than the perverse reaction to the film. So in a way, it kind of, a lot of us are in a queer spectator position and deriving pleasure from things. You know, a lot of the work that I do is on queer spectatorship and, you know, not so much what did the filmmaker intend, but like how do audiences derive meaning from it, often like subcultural audiences. And there's a really good piece by Eve Sedgwick that kind of changed a lot of my critical work. And in it, she says, I'm so tired of talking about how films hurt me. I want to talk about pleasure, and I want to talk about how resourceful the queer spectator is and how they're scavengers and how they are scrappy and they derive meaning that maybe isn't intended. And we laugh at straight culture through camp, right? This is like the power of the queer spectator. And so a lot of that guides my research and thinking about pleasure. And I think it's an important question for us to ask.
I'm just thinking about an article that I read about the Dahmer stuff.
Yeah.
That's been happening, and actors who are saying like, yeah, I keep doing these villains because it's more fun. They're more well-rounded. Mm-hmm. That feels like it touches on what you're talking about too.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of villains that kind of threaten to take over the film or are more interesting and more charismatic. I mean, they populate a lot of Hitchcock's films, and usually in thrillers, you know, the villain is more interesting and more rounded and nuanced because the protagonist is just good. You know, and often that can be a really flat representation and not as easy to identify with. You know, it's the villains that propel the plot forward. By and large, heroes react to the villains. So I don't know. There's a lot of power in the villain. Back in, 92, I think, or 96, when Basic Instinct came out, GLAAD was up in arms against it because, the byline said, bisexual woman, you know, commits murder. And they thought, bad representation. But if you watch Basic Instinct, it's really fun. It's really fun to see Sharon Stone, you know, turn the tables on these cops in this sort of patriarchal sense and use her body to kind of like render them catatonic. So I don't know. I think we get a little misguided in thinking that villain is always bad and that it can't be a site of pleasurable engagement.
Just for listeners who might not know GLAAD, can you give a little background about GLAAD and what they do?
Yeah, GLAAD is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and they do great work and have worked to kind of ferret out negative representations of queer people and to mostly inform, movie studios, newspapers, other media outlets about queer people's lives and the sort of the stigmatizing words that they might be using or representations and the alternatives. And I think they have evolved quite a bit too. But in the early days, I think it was a pretty narrow definition of positive.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. So you are specifically, you're talking about films, you're talking about horror. How did, just to roll it back a little bit, how did you get interested in this? Because it sounds like you've dedicated your career to talking about horror and film.
Yeah, I definitely have. I guess I get interested in genres that move your body, that makes your body do things. And I'm really interested in, gosh, probably the primary question about horror, which is why? Why would we volunteer for an experience that makes us terrified? Seems to work against every kind of evolutionary code that we have, that we would avoid this at all costs. So I guess the pleasure of horror is the big question for me, and it's something I've just been investigating my whole career. And you know, in the early days of writing about horror, people assumed that horror was about sadism, that we watched it because we kind of repress all of our instincts in our daily lives, and this is a space where we can kind of live out those violent fantasies. And that was dominant for a while until somebody came along and said, hey, but like when I'm watching a horror movie, I don't identify with the monster. I identify with the victim much more, you know? And so then we said, okay, so is the primary pleasure of horror masochistic? Do we go because we're all in search of some sort of Thanatos death drive thing? Is that the impulse? That doesn't seem to work either, you know? And I think what is true is that we go to horror films and we do get triggered. We have this emotional response. Our adrenaline rises, our palms sweat. And we can experience our fear of death in the safety of a theater seat or in the safety of our home. And so it's almost like a surrogate space where we can experience trauma in a containable sphere and in some ways control our fear of violence and death in those kind of circumstances. There are definitely things that are too much for me and I have to turn it off. And so I'm kind of, you know, I know usually that boundary, although sometimes I can be surprised. It's, I mean, depending on what true crime you listen to, it is completely depraved and depressing and it can be a horrible experience. But there's something too about the way that a podcast or a mini series about true crime, the way it wraps up in the end, can be very satisfying. You know, one of the most popular genres in the 1930s was a universal horror film, which doesn't seem to make any sense because here's people in the throes of the Great Depression. But what's interesting is that, especially in the early days, horror films were actually about containment more than about threat. And they promised you that whatever, you know, it gets released, we'll be able to tamp it back down. And there is a satisfaction, I think, to true crime there that they are eventually caught and brought to justice. And I mean, I think the most depressing ones, of course, are the ones that they never are.
For sure. A lot of the topics that you seem interested in are really influenced by social issues. They're not necessarily operating in a vacuum. I think the best horror often has some sort of social commentary. Yeah. How do you think about that in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. You know, I think all horror is about something. It has a belief system. And part of the job of the kind of social critic or the film critic is to delve into it and say, okay, let's reveal this film's belief system, good or bad, oftentimes bad. I'm very interested in conservative periods and the art that gets created during conservative periods, because a lot of times the horror is the counterculture genre. It is expressing fears that maybe can't be articulated yet. And I guess that's another reason I love horror, because it only works if it taps into a particular fear in a particular time and place. And so for me, it's always immediately topical and has that power. Because one of the great things that horror can do is it takes things that are often ineffable or not concrete and makes them concrete by turning them into a monster. So something like Get Out, it is hard to get to systemic racism, right? Because its job is to remain invisible. And so by making it into a metaphor, we can articulate these anxieties a lot better.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm your host, Elise Matatal, and I've been nerding out with CU Denver film professor and horror enthusiast, Dr. Andy Scahill. Can you think of examples where that hasn't gone well, where it's just maybe sort of juvenile analysis is not great?
Yeah, I mean, there are loads of heavy-handed horror fantasy films, and I tend to groan when the metaphor is the one that really made me groan was Mother with Jennifer Lawrence. I just, you know, I am watching it. Sorry, spoilers, but I'm watching it and saying, you know, it's pretty obvious that it's a biblical metaphor. And these two brothers show up. And I'm like, if Cain kills Abel, I'm going to lose my mind. And of course, that's what happens. And so I don't know. I don't like those types of films because I feel like they treat their audience like they're stupid. And they talk down to them, like, you're not going to get this until I make it super obvious. And so I like a subtle hand, I guess. Something like It Follows is really interesting. And because it's targeting back to the 1980s, and I would say it seems like it's about STDs, but I think it's something actually a lot more complicated and a lot more hard to articulate, which is how precarious middle class status is. Those of you who haven't seen this film, it is there is a thing that can take any form that just once you're cursed with this thing, it follows you, and you can run away, but it'll just keep following you until it catches you. Now, you can give away the curse to someone else by having sex with them, and that kind of divests you of the curse, and now it's on them. But if they die, it comes back after you. And so it's a perpetual cycle. You can never really get rid of it. And what's fascinating about the film is when someone gets cursed by this thing, they leave their suburban homes and they retreat into the inner city. And so for me, it's really about class, and it's about how hard it is to maintain middle-class status, and how the only way you can maintain your middle-class status is to consistently F over other people, right? In the most literal sense, you're screwing them. But it'll always come back for you.
Oh, I have heard that one listed before, but now it's on my top like Halloween spooky season.
You should definitely see it. It's fascinating as a film. I think it really works.
That's awesome. Do you have like a top five? I know it's probably truly like choosing one of your babies, but top five like TV shows, movies.
Okay. Gosh, this is hard. For TV shows, you know, there's a TV show that no one is watching and it makes me sad. It's called Undone. And it is maybe Amazon, but it involves a woman that her father, she's thought all her life that her father went crazy and had to be institutionalized. And then one day she gets in a car accident and she basically starts to have the same hallucinations that he does. And the question is, is she going crazy? Does she have a concussion or some brain injury? Or has she unlocked a part of her brain that her father also did that allows her to kind of travel through time and see other parts of the world that are invisible to the naked eye? I think it's a really beautiful show, and it's rotoscoped over. So that's where you take live action and then you kind of paint over it or draw over it, and it's beautiful. The transitions are gorgeous. And it does kind of what animation can do really well. You know, I think a lot of the really interesting like contemporary horror is happening overseas. There's a film called Bacurau that is from Brazil. Brazil is doing really interesting things with the genre right now. That's kind of a revenge Western. And the setup is that there is a small town in Brazil, Bacurau, that if you're wealthy enough, you can pay to have any small town in Brazil erased from Google Maps. And then they go in and they kind of live out their Call of Duty fantasy and kind of slaughter the village. And this, it's very like Purge. But what's great about the film is that these residents of Bacurau have been through several political revolutions. And so they know how to fight back. And it becomes this really satisfying post-colonial revenge fantasy. Gosh, I'd have to think about the other ones. I love It Follows. I loved Nia Costa's recent remake of Candyman. You know, I think that thoughtful horror or progressive horror is making a comeback. And I think a lot of us feel this way with you know, Trump in office previously and human rights being evacuated currently, that the greatest threat to our lives is not xenophobic, which would be a kind of conservative horror film, but our own culture, our own government. I think we have moved from here's the normative culture and it's being threatened from an outside force to this is what it feels like to be a minority in majority culture. And I think that is the more common narrative that we get a lot of horror today.
I'm thinking about sort of the grandfather of horror, H.P. Lovecraft, and just learning about like his racism and that truly it was not a metaphor, or it was a metaphor for like the black and brown masses coming. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. So how has horror sort of reconciled with that sometimes super racist history?
I mean, it's true. And there are still those films and still those perspectives on film. I think educating people about the undercurrent, you know, when I teach film, I tell my students that I'm not just teaching you movies or what good movies are. I think a lot of students might come in with that idea. What I think I'm teaching is media literacy. And given that our students primarily get their information about the world from visual media, no one's really telling them how to deconstruct media, how music impacts them, how editing impacts them. And I think these are important lessons for students to learn in an era of artificial news and misleading headlines and juxtaposition of photos in newspapers that lead to certain points of view. It's people need to understand how to break down media and understand how it works and how it can be influencing.
It seems like you're pretty involved in, I mean, you're running this Rainbow Cult series, you're pretty involved in the community. What's your responsibility to sort of share those media literacy skills or like this niche knowledge that you have beyond the classroom?
You know, I would do movie nights in my backyard, and I've been doing them for about 3 years. When COVID hit, I started doing them every week because there was just nothing else to do. And I had a backyard and people could distance themselves properly. And that's a real source of pleasure for me. I like helping people wade through, the myriad of options with media today. It can be kind of overwhelming to find good media. And it all seems buried in this sort of plethora of choices. So there's something really fun for me about that, to share films with people that I think deserve more attention. But along the way, I'd like to I'll give a couple of remarks before the film, why I think it's worthy of study, why I think it's doing something interesting. And so I think bringing that to, a different level. It's not ivory tower academic kind of stuff. I think being a public scholar, what we call it, I think there's a real power and a real usefulness to that.
Totally. That's so important. I guess in our last couple of minutes, any plugs, things you want to share, projects you're working on that you're excited about, I'll pass it off to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now's your time to share with listeners.
Thank you. On October 11th is when we'll have our next Rainbow Cult. That's a Tuesday. And the film is going to be Death Becomes Her, which has become a real cult classic, infinitely quotable. I think it's a compelling film, too, just about aging and our anxiety about getting older. And it has, I think, fantastic performances. Meryl Streep, Goldie Hawn are really, I think, top of their game. And we always do something kind of interactive with Rainbow Cult. When we did Troop Beverly Hills, we gave out Girl Scout cookies during the film, and we had people create gay merit badges, like I Survived My Family at Christmas. When we did Drop Dead Gorgeous, we gave everyone tiaras and sashes. And I will say, it's a powerful thing, you know, growing up with this sort of femme phobia, that to look out in the audience and see so many, everyone, and men included, in tiaras and sashes is really kind of a powerful thing. For this one, we have a really fun activity before the film Death Becomes Her. We're going to have a dead celebrity ball where people dress up like their favorite dead celebrity, and we'll have a contest. And so we're looking forward to that. Rainbow Cult for me is, I think during COVID, I lost that sense of community and togetherness, and thought about ways in which to get that back, and to have a theater full of queer people, all who love this film or excited to see this film and quoting it. I think it's a really powerful thing. And I think we can't underestimate the power of laughing together, for sing along bingo, the power of singing together. I think we think of these things as maybe mere entertainment or mere distraction, but I say, what's so mere about entertainment, really?
Something I've been thinking a lot about recently is like pleasure activism, because the world is so scary and hard. How do we like sustain ourselves and build community to fight the real battles outside of Rainbow Cult?
Yeah, and protest fatigue is a real thing, and it is tough to read the headlines every morning and to be depressed and scared about what happened since I closed my eyes last night. But I do think we need to centralized pleasure, for our mental health, for kind of the very reasons you articulate, that it is tough to be an activist and to, you know, sit in that space of righteous anger.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time and nerding out about movies and horror.
That's my favorite thing. So anytime I get the chance to talk about movies, I will take it.
Great. Do you have any places where people can find you, like social media, sure, places that you are a public scholar?
Yes, absolutely. So I have a personal website that'll have my scholarship on it. That is adscahill.com. I'm on Twitter, Andrew Scahill, and the Rainbow Cult site, which we've just revamped. I'm really happy with it. That is rainbowcultdenver.com.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU, Boulder, Denver. I'm Elise Matitol, and you just heard my conversation with film professor Dr. Andy Scahill. For more information about Dr. Scahill and his film event series, Rainbow Cult, you can visit news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Join us next week, Monday, at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of Outsources, providing you homegrown queer radio every week. That's Monday, 6:30 p.m. right here on KGNU, or listen anytime after the broadcast at kgnu.org/outsources. Yes, this fear's got a hold on me. Yes, this fear's got a hold on me. This fear's got a hold on me. Yes, this fear.